Hey, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Frank About Health. It is February 12, 2025. I'm still wearing my red for Heart Health Awareness Month, and I'm glad that you are here to meet with me and my favorite co-host, Phyllis Quinlan, and in addition to our special guest today, Lynn Rapp-Silber. Both of them are nurse professionals, and I have to say that we're going to get a very interesting take, not just from the global view of nursing, which you've heard on this show many times from Phyllis, but also in the role of nurse practitioner, which is what Lynn Rapp-Silber is part of, in terms of her advocacy group, her entrepreneurial network, as well as other information that you're going to get on this particular episode of Frank About Health. I will issue my usual disclaimer. Any of the information you hear today are not the views of talkradio.nyc or of Frank About Health, but they represent what is going on in the nursing profession today. If this is not a topic of interest for yourself, that is fine. It's food for thought to be taken as just information to converse about with your family, friends, fellow caregivers, so forth and so on. That being said, I want to first take the time to tell you why I chose to name this episode Nurse Practitioners Need a Seat at the Table. That's because, as you all know from my Voices of Disruption campaign, our healthcare system has been going through just that, total disruption. It could be political, it could be economic, it could be social, it could be new technologies or innovations that have been funded or defunded. It could be a whole host of things, but that does not change the dynamics of the individual caregivers or doctors or specialists or nurses or nurse practitioners. They all have the same role, which either gets restricted or gets expanded depending on the hospital system or the circumstances that might be involved. For myself, an avid caregiver for the last 4 years, especially for my father, still recovering from prostate cancer, I have seen many nurse practitioners come inside this house to view the different side effects that my father has been going through, to view his typical vital readings and understanding of his mobility and other kind of limitations that he has now had to adapt to. And I always come up with the question, what is really the difference between this nurse practitioner and the nurse that was here last month? So I am going to be sitting here in this episode as a student. So I want to spend most of this particular episode of this segment of the show introducing both of them. I will let Lynn go first to introduce her background and her information and what she would like all of you to have as a takeaway once this episode ends. And then Phyllis will, of course, moderate the conversation with Lynn over the segments 2 and 3 to really show the dynamic differences between the two nurse professionals, because they have roles that intersect as well as roles that are completely differentiated. All right, I guess, geez, Phyllis, I think I gave a little monologue there. That's one of my first, you know.
But no, that's okay. You did a good job. You did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you. And so, of course, welcome back, Phyllis, all the time. And Lynn, welcome to Frank About Health. Once you unmute, I'd like you to just share with my audience of listeners and followers your background. And what brings you to Frank About Health. Oh, and by the way, thank you to Sam Leibowitz, because I know that not only did you refer me to Phyllis all those years ago, but you have also referred me to Lynn. So I want to thank you for that. Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Sam. And thank you, Frank, for being here. And Phyllis, it's a pleasure to meet you as well. My background, I'm a nurse practitioner, and I recognized early on that nurses needed business education. We don't get education and training in this field. And when I was a new nurse, I actually worked on a cancer floor, and the oncologist decided to tap me to run their outpatient chemo program. This was in 1985, which was unheard of at that time. Mm-hmm. So I basically said, you know, I'll try it. What's the worst that can happen? And I'll go back to the hospital if it doesn't work out. Well, I was there 20 years. And what I learned is that I was an entrepreneur back then, and I didn't know it. Mm-hmm. But I had to find the chemo drugs, research them, how much time it took to deliver the treatment, the supplies I needed, what CPT, ICD, went to the insurance companies, negotiated the rates. I did that as a nurse. And then as the chemo program was developing and I was adding more staff, I was starting to do higher level nursing functions. So I decided to go back to school and get my NP. And from that, I actually started to think more about how can we cultivate our business brains and get more people involved in opening up their own practices so that we can start to fill the gaps in healthcare? And we realize that there's no business education. So physicians, PAs, and nurse practitioners get little. And so we created the National Nurse Practitioner Entrepreneur Network so that we could coalesce all the resources to put thoroughbreds in a stable so that we have all these resources for our NPs to be safe clinicians and to provide care in the communities that they serve, but to give them the knowledge and skill set so they could be successful and sustainable, because that's what we need to change healthcare.
I agree. I agree. Well, welcome.
Welcome, 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 welcome. Yes. I couldn't agree with you more, Lynn. You know, just coming at it from like the administrative piece, because you went the NP route, I went the PhD route. But, you know, being a nurse executive, probably the thing that was lacking most in most nurse executive training is the financial piece. And you learn in a hurry. You know, I've often said to people who have asked me, should I get an MBA? The first thing I tell them is by all means, go for the MBA, because you need to have that financial background. You're going to be sitting in a room with bean counters. And if you don't know what you're talking about, they're going to take your beans, you know? So you definitely need to be able to, at least understand the vernacular. You need to understand the concepts. You need to be able to look at a spreadsheet. You need to be able to reconcile your spreadsheet with your staffing sheet and then sit down and have a cup of coffee with the director of finance and say, what's missing here, you know, and I want it back, you know. So, and of course, now with so many new models coming up from an administrative point of view, you need to be able to price out a project management scheme. You need to be able to, you know, take a look at phase one, phase two. What are the, you know, the things that we are going to need, what, you know, to make that work, what's staff, what's durable medical equipment. And we are now thinking in terms of business people, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, you're now a nurse with an accounting background or an accounting understanding in order to fulfill the new demand and the bandwidth of what nurse executives are expected to have. So I welcome this opportunity for you certainly to enlighten everyone as to, you know, especially your NP colleagues, as to the gap that they are having in their education, and that your organization is so very valuable in coalescing, you know, a group of like-minded people, and then fill that gap with the appropriate training. And it's not necessarily staffing and such for you. It is, as you say, the coding, the billing, making sure the documentation is there so that you survive the audits, and making sure that you advocate for those things that are necessary, because I do feel that the advanced care practitioner nurse, the nurse practitioner, is here to stay. It may morph and change as everything always does, but having gone through COVID with them, invaluable. We would not be here. Many of us would not be here if it wasn't for the advanced, you know, for the nurse practitioners with advanced training.
Absolutely.
So can you just briefly tell us just a little bit about your organization? We'll save that for another thing, you know, details down the road, but just a little overview.
We started the National Nurse Practitioner Entrepreneur Network and took in our first member in 2018. And we started out with a program called Office Hours, which is an hour program that we offer a CE for, and it's a hot topic related to practice ownership. And all of that content from 2018 has been recorded. So we have that in our library. So there's a lot of resources for NPs to go back and review this information. And we offer, like I say, the CE for that. From that, we started to develop more programs. I did coding and billing programs, and then we added conferencing. So we would have a conference every year. And we also added a Business Basics Accelerator course. And that is a 12-week asynchronous, so people can do their content during the week so they can, you know, fit that into their schedule, however. And then we would meet as a cohort on Zoom once a week. So they were not building these businesses in isolation, but lifting each other up and supporting each other. The networking in the community was really invaluable. And we're going into our 12th cohort. We're just starting a new one now. So if anybody's interested, they can still get in. But we our success rate is 85% of our attendees start their businesses. So that's a good track record. And our courses are taught by content experts. So we have a marketing person, a revenue cycle, somebody doing the financials. So you're getting it from, like I say, our thoroughbreds in the stable.
I think that's just amazing. I remember when I first started my company 32 years ago, the purist in our profession looked at me in shock and horror. You're departing from, advocating for the patient, and you're going to get money hungry and all of, the negative connotations that might come with just maybe a fixed mindset about the profession as it was 32 years ago. Clearly things have changed, things have expanded. And as you get more education, how do you keep them down on the farm? They're going to think of other ways in order to practice and expand and increase access. And there was never a time, regardless if you're hospital-based or an entrepreneur, there's never a time that the patient isn't at the center of everything. You're just approaching them from a different point of view.
Exactly. And that's what's the differentiation of a nurse practitioner is the patient is at the forefront and the care is built around their needs.
I share, Frank, with you when you have the NPs come to the house to take care of your dad.
Yes.
I can relate to that because my parents would go to the doctor's office, and I would give them a list, on a card of the here's the questions to ask, and then I would have to, say a quick prayer that they remember to bring the card, that type of thing. And they would never let me go with them because that just was unthinkable. So then their visit, the doctor's visit would be completed, and I would call and say to my, my mom, well, what did the doctor say? Oh, he's fine. He's doing good. His grandchildren are good. No, what did the doctor say about you? And, after a few minutes of frustration, I wasn't going to get much anywhere. He's going to keep me on the blue pill. God only knows what that was. That I finally would have to call the practice, and the practice, thank you, God, had a nurse practitioner who I had a relationship with. And I would say, Mary, Jack and Madeline were in the, oh, I saw them this morning. Aren't they cute? And she says, you're here for the update. Yeah, she didn't, she forgot the question. She forgot the card on the kitchen table. I'm like, okay. So then I would find out from Mary, what the point was. And, it's just the way you have to be able to navigate things to keep body and soul and frail elderly parents together.
You have to meet the
Absolutely.
patients where they are.
Got to meet the patients where they're at.
Absolutely.
Nurses are excellent at that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we're about to take our first break, but then we're going to really delve into a lot of what we just covered in this first segment. Lynn, I already do have one question, but I will introduce the second segment with that question. And I just want to tell everybody if you are watching right now on YouTube, Facebook, or LinkedIn and have any live questions that you'd like to share with Phyllis, Lynn, or myself, by all means, just go into your chat bot. And we will have it read out loud through our panel right here and our engineer support. So, that all being said, please stay tuned right here on talkradio.nyc and on our social media platforms, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitch, and YouTube. And we'll be back in a few.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Hey everybody, and welcome back. So Lynn, let me ask you one question that came to my mind when Phyllis was just going over her experience over the last 32 years. If nurse practitioners are trusted and trained, which I know that they are, why are they still restricted? You have to unmute first.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No problem.
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I think a lot about our profession as a whole. And I don't think that we've really had a time when we've really gotten together, academics, clinicians, and really, you know, work together for policy and advocacy and our profession. And I think that fragmentation has led to opportunities where barriers to practice have been put up or things like that. So I think that that's been one thing that's been, I think, a little bit of a concern. I'm very excited, though, because I think some of the things we're hearing in the nursing world right now with nursing not a professional degree for loans mm-hmm. has really kind of coalesced us and fired us up mm-hmm. to start working together. And I think that kind of spark is really what we need to do, because there's 5 million nurses, and that is a big voice, a big vocal presence. And if we can mobilize that, boy, we can move a lot of mountains.
Amazing. Yep. So I know that, you know, there's just, like I said in the beginning of the show, there's just been a lot of disruption that I personally, and I think, Phyllis, you agree with me, it's just unnecessary. But on one level, it does spark the entrepreneurial aspect of your career, which at the end of the day is always admirable. But at the same time, do you see that the restrictions have been because of that increased disruption that's been going on, or is it just more related to what has historically been happening in the profession?
Well, it's interesting because during COVID, the public health emergency happened. And as Phyllis described earlier, is that, you know, APRNs and RNs were able to move about the country to go where the needs, the crisis needs were, whether it was Washington State or New York, for example. And 2.5 years, we had full practice where we could go wherever we needed to. We could move about the cab and deliver that care. And then all of a sudden, the pandemic ends and the public health emergency waivers are gone. And it just, all of a sudden, everybody's trying to stuff that genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. And that has been very disruptive for us. And I'll give you an example. In New Jersey, for example, before the public health emergency, the governor signed an executive order and they had full practice authority for about 6 years. And then now, because there's a new governor, the executive orders are no longer in place. So now they are trying to go ahead and get that full practice authority, but they're being challenged. And it's like, I don't understand. We were able to provide this care for 2.5 years and people need access to care, and we fill gaps in care and go to places a lot of physicians probably don't go to, generally rural areas and things like that. And we're growing. We're 461,000 nurse practitioners and we're continuing to grow. So, you know, you have a workforce here that's ready and we need to utilize it as best we can to help solve the healthcare crisis.
Absolutely.
Frank, so, can I just jump in? Because sure, I think it's really important for your listeners right now to understand the evolution of nursing and how that started, and really just have some background. Because to your point, when you opened up, you know, what's the difference between an RN and a nurse practitioner? And you know, how does this happen? And is a nurse practitioner more of a nurse than a physician, or a physician more than a nurse? So
right.
I'm just going to take a minute and sure. Just really go through a very brief overview of the profession of nursing history, and just, you know, a little bit about the academic preparation. So I think most people realize if we went back to ancient times, you know, in earlier times, you know, care was rendered essentially by your family. All right. So, and of course, there were shamans, there were religious orders, and that was really the group, because the physicality and the illnesses were viewed in various cultures as one thing or another. So there was a specialty group that treated that. And, you know, it was really the foundation of caring. It was the foundation of taking a look at, you know, really hit and miss, what works, what doesn't. A lot of holistic approaches to healing back then in various countries. The Chinese medicine at that time, again, you know, back way, way back in time, was far more advanced than some of the Western approaches. But slowly but surely, the modern era did develop. And I think if we're really talking about nursing, most of us would agree that the modern era of nursing started with Florence Nightingale. And mm-hmm. that was really, she was there in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And of course, she's very much connected with the Crimean War, but very few people realize the reason what made Florence Florence was that she was the daughter of a British banker, and she had an aptitude for math, and her father homeschooled her in math, which of course was unheard of, but women were not, you know, allowed into academic settings back in that time. So she went into nursing, but she really started the whole idea of epidemiology and statistics, so that when she did care, and she would talk about very fundamental things, she would talk about fresh air, she would talk about sunshine, you know, and she actually did statistics to back what she was doing. And that's how she captured the attention of the British military leaders at the time. And that's how she got her funding. She mm-hmm. was able to start a school, the first school of nursing. And again, I'm sure there are other references, but we're going to stick with Florence for now. We're mm-hmm. going to say the first school of nursing was started around 1860 in London by Florence. And it was more of an apprenticeship program than anything else. This really started something very different. It started to shift the nursing away from religious organizations into more secular, largely female-dominated professions. And it started to become an absolute choice for women at that time. In fact, in some of Florence Nightingale's writings, she actually talks about women setting aside a portion of their, nurses rather, setting aside a portion of their salary in savings, so they don't become a burden on society as they age.
Mm.
She even had the vision of Social Security, or, you know, I guess her version of a 401, you know, or 403B.
Yes, retirement plan.
But you can see the banking piece in her head at that point. You know, we smile about this and we talk about Florence, but really, you know, she is really the shoulders that we stand on. And, you know, nursing is, I think now, probably for about 18 or 19 years, considered the most trusted profession in the world. And you know, it's an honor, but it's also a lot of stewardship that goes with that, when you want to make sure we never drop that ball. So again, how did we develop from an education, you know, from an education standpoint? So really, in and around the late 19th centuries, we started to see something called the hospital-based diploma schools, where nurses would affiliate with a particular hospital. And mm-hmm. so you may remember St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City.
Yes.
Back in the 60s and 70s was considered the creme de la creme. It was world class.
Yes.
Other schools of nursing, again, hospital-based and affiliated, and it was an apprenticeship model, very similar to the Florence Nightingale model, where the students came and applied for the program. They lived in the hospital in dorms, and mm-hmm. they worked very long shifts, so they went to school days. Perhaps they did schoolwork, but they were essentially the night shift and maybe the evening shift for the hospital. So there was a little indentured servitude there going. But that was in, you know, they actually worked and took care of patients. Their skills were amazing. They knew exactly what was expected of them by the time they graduated. These were 2 and 3 year programs, depending on the school itself. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, a work study program, and it paid for the room and board and your training. And in exchange, you took care of patients and you worked for the hospital. Then, of course, the wars started to happen. So when we're thinking about World War One and World War Two, mostly I want to talk about in and around World War Two. Mm-hmm. The nursing staff, they started with corpsmen, and of course, they were nurses. But when they came back from World War II, what really happened is these nurses were extremely skilled. They had seen things, you can only imagine what they saw. So they started to realize that hospital-based programs were just not going to be enough. And there was a slow shift towards academia. That started post-World War II, but it really took off with Korea and Vietnam. When those nurses came back from Korea, especially Vietnam, in the 60s, you know, mid-60s, they really, everything shifted to the college sites. Yes. And we started with the two-year programs. The transition was slow. Again, as I say, it started in World War II. It continued in after Korea, and then of course after Vietnam. The associate degree program slowly started in the 50s, and then they were, you know, considered, you know, pretty radical at the time. But in 1965, the American Nurses Association put out a position paper saying that they were advocating for all nursing education to be at a higher education institute, cementing the need for us to be trained at universities. And that's really when the modern nursing programs began. So you're looking at 1965, clearly post-Korea and post-Vietnam. The associate programs were 2 years in the making, and then slowly but surely the four-year programs came up. So there was a lot of back and forth in political pieces, and of course economics played a part. And again, for women, it was not just going to school and having a career, it was going to school, getting married and having a career and having children, and then trying to figure out a way not only to get an associate's degree but a baccalaureate degree. So, you know, it's always been, you know, a little bit like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. We dance the same steps, and we do it in high heels and backwards. You know, it's, you know, it's just a little bit more challenging. And it's certainly, they were early pioneers. And you know, I give them all the credit in the world for seeing the vision of where nursing could be from an academic perspective. Mm-hmm. Doing that, the key drivers really started to be when we started in the 70s, and we started to see some of the CNSs, clinical nurse specialists, master's prepared nurses and nurse practitioners. And we needed them because we needed them to go back to college and teach nurses the baccalaureate programs, the academic and the baccalaureate programs.
Yes.
It really is important to understand that prior to, you know, around the 1970s, nurses were going for advanced degrees, but they weren't going for advanced degrees in nursing. They were going into law and other things, teaching. And finally, we were able to get enough nurses prepared that they were able to swing back and then join academic groups and start Department of Nursing Education at the academic level. Once we had the baccalaureate program in place, and we've tried for years, and there's probably still a lot of debate going on, is that is the gold standard for entry into the profession. And again, then the advanced practice started. So it was really in the 70s and 80s that we had the shift to clinical nurse specialists, nurse practitioners, and then ultimately we're looking at nurses being prepared at the doctorate level. Of the 5 million nurses that Lynn referenced, about 7% are prepared at the doctorate level today. So nice. What does it take to be an NP? I'm going to let Lynn explain that.
When we return from our break.
Sure. Okay.
And then, of course, at the same time, when we return, not only after you explain what is going on in the future, there's the entrepreneurial side that we want to also uncover. Everyone, just stay tuned. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we're ready.
On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Now, Lynn, what Phyllis was just talking about is a very interesting history on the growth of the nursing profession. And I guess, Lynn, you were now going to talk about how the nurse practitioner was able to evolve out of that.
Yes, actually, we often refer to the founder of the nurse practitioner profession as the great disruptor. Dr. Loretta Ford, who just passed away last fall, an amazing woman. I've gotten to meet her several times, and she always would ask, you know, how are you doing? And, you know, keep up the fight. And she had all these wonderful pearls of wisdom, but she recognized that nurse practitioners need to go out into the community, and she had a strong focus in public health. And that's where the roots of nurse practitioners evolve. Her and Dr. Silver created the nurse practitioner role, and it has evolved over time. It started out, and then the programs expanded depending on adding pharmacology and other pieces to the program. So now the programs are such that they're very robust in education and training nurses in the higher level functions. So basically, you have to have your RN license, and then you're working for a period of time. And then many times when you're working, you decide, hey, I think I might want to go on for an advanced degree. And there's different opportunities for nurse practitioners because we're population focused. So you can go into adult GRO, which is adult cradle to grave, pretty much. Pediatric nurse practitioner, there's a family nurse practitioner, psych mental health nurse practitioner, women's health nurse practitioner, all of them are population focused. So you start out as a nurse, then you apply to NP school and you get into the NP program. And from that, you have your course curriculum. So you have your didactic preparation and your clinical. So you do get the opportunity to specialize in that population focus area. So we can get trained in assessing, diagnosing, treating, prescribing, ordering tests, all the, those facets of healthcare that we can provide to our patients. Mm-hmm. Along the way, it's all competency-based, so you can't go on to the next level until you make sure that you're competent in the level that you're at. When you complete your coursework, then you have to sit for a certification exam. So you actually have to prove that the education you received provides you with the certification to go out and practice. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you apply for your licensure, whatever state you're in. And that varies depending on the state. So we don't have it easy, no matter how you look at it. So we all, and most of the states, we have to maintain our RN license and our APRN license. So we're responsible for maintaining two degrees or two licensures, I'm sorry. Yeah. But our education and training does prepare us when we leave the profession to go out and deliver care to our patients. Which is
Lynn,
great.
Could you share the clinical hours that go with the didactic, please? I think because they're impressive.
Yeah. So when we start out with baccalaureate, we get 750 hours of clinical training. So that's carried over into our APRN training. And when you get to be a master's prepared, you get another 750 mm-hmm. hours of clinical training. Mm-hmm. And then when you go on, you can get additional 4 hours. It really depends on whether you decide to do the program full time or part time. Right. How much clinical you actually get. But by the time an APRN graduates, if they've been a full-time student, they'll have 4,300 hours of clinical practice. Right. And if they've done part-time, then they'll have 6,500 hours. So, you know, that's a lot of training. So we're basically building on the framework of our RN education and getting the skill set in the APRN training.
I think it's so essential for your listeners, Frank, to understand that the nurses are not just sitting in a classroom and going to take care of patients, right. That when we're looking at thousands of clinical hours of training that goes with this, very similar to, you know, a medical student graduating in their first year of practice as what we used to say an intern, we now call a postgraduate one, PGY1. You know, these are comparable hours to what's going on with the competencies, the licensure, and the certifications. I remember back in the day, I think it might have been the late 70s, early 80s, the first advanced care role that I became aware of was a nurse anesthetist role. Mm-hmm. Then. Am I right? Is that the first one?
They actually came out of the war.
Yes,
yeah, they were giving anesthesia. That, yeah.
They were doing that. That exactly. So again, my reference to it's amazing the silver lining that war produced. You know, the certainly all of the nurses with just incredible skills and incredible training, and they were cross trained literally in the field by physicians because. Unfortunately, the soldiers, you know, were coming in far more rapidly than the staffing could handle. But, you know, from there, you know, we now get all these specialties. And I think it's, you know, it's really important, again, to share that, you know, we've all done anatomy and physiology, but I'm looking at the core curriculum for any advanced care program. And you're looking at advanced, for, you know, advanced physiology, advanced pathophysiology, advanced pharmacology, because you do have the ability to prescribe at the end of this, advanced health assessment, and then, of course, everything you need. In the evolution of nursing, we realize that you just can't say, well, you know, I used to put my Lantor on a pressure ulcer and it changed the pH and it worked. You know, we have to have evidence, rhyme, and reason, and the science, you know, to put behind what we do, because nursing is an art and a science. And just to do it because it seemed to work last time is just not good enough.
Right.
And to your point, bringing up the research, the patient care research, there's over 50 years of studies that are show that nurse practitioner care is cost effective, comparable quality with physicians. So, you know, we're par for what services, how we're delivering that service to our clients and getting them to their optimum level of wellness. You know, so the studies show that we just do it a different pathway, but, you know, the outcomes are good. So that should reassure folks that from a safety perspective, and again, 2.5 years of COVID.
Of COVID, and we would not have gotten through COVID without you guys. I think it's you know, interesting that the NPs, of course, you know, had their basis in community health, or, you know, and now really I see a lot of telemedicine that's being driven by the nurse practitioners. Again, a modern day spin on community health, if you will. But what I think is so important for everyone to understand is not just the history, not just the credentialing, the academic preparation, the clinical hours, but what it means to the patient. Because how many nurse practitioners now, Lynn?
461,000.
And every one of them ensuring more access to people who otherwise may not have good primary care.
And it's interesting, too, because from the national nurse practitioner perspective, a lot of NPs will see needs in their communities and they want to build a practice around that. They're getting frustrated with the current healthcare system because it's compartmentalizing them into shorter visits, 15 minutes. You know, you're lucky if you can get a half an hour. Our brains are hardwired to deliver whole person care, and you can't do that in 15 minutes without burning yourself out. So I think a lot of these nurse practitioners are saying, well, there's got to be a better way to do this. How can I get the care I want to deliver to patients? And starting your practice is the best way to do that. And many do it as a side hustle. They're keeping their day job and transitioning into the NP to the business side. Yes. And doing it, you know, gradually building that up. But they're seeing the needs in the communities. And I think that's fascinating. I mean, the types of practices we're seeing them start are amazing.
Right. And I know that there's a lot of chatter, if you will, around, you know, they're serving a concierge population, if you will. But I think, you know, the pendulum has always been it swings one way, far way, then it swings back far the other way. And I think for, you know, to be able to start your own practice, regardless of the population you are serving, is so vital to bring awareness to what you offer the industry and the profession and the patients at large. And I do think, as, for lack of a better term, concierge patients become, as that patient population grows, then I see the third party payers are going to have to say, wait a second, we're missing out on a huge population here. Perhaps we should now start to develop the coding and the billing, and mm-hmm. of course the legislature, and to support the practices so that they can you can see more patients than just those that are fortunate enough to be able to pay fee for service.
And it's interesting too, because a lot of the baby boomers are mm-hmm. aging, and now we're all in the Medicare space, mm-hmm. and we want to stay healthy. Yeah. I can't tell you how many older folks want to be healthy. We don't mm-hmm. we don't see ourselves going into a nursing home, mm-hmm. but a lot of what nurse practitioner care delivers is that ability to do prevention and health promotion and keep those folks healthier. And or if they have chronic diseases, identify them early and get them into the proper treatment so we can prevent the long-term complications that happen.
So is that part of the entrepreneurial mindset that the nurse practitioner has in order to do nursing home prevention?
It's embedded in our brains. That's how we're hardwired, you know, to look at that person. And it's interesting, too, because a lot of nurse practitioners, 80% of us are seeing Medicaid patients, mm-hmm. 74% are seeing Medicare, mm-hmm. and 77% see private insurance. But our concern is with the ACA subsidies going away and people paying a lot more for health insurance that people are going to go without. And concierge is great if somebody can afford to pay.
Can afford it, yep.
Right. So I think what we're looking at in our entrepreneurial network is how can we take care of the Medicare and Medicaid, mm-hmm. the underinsured, uninsured, the populations that really need us, but then also support our practices with add-on services. And so aesthetics is one area that we can provide some additional service. We can do VA disability physicals. There's a backlog of veterans who need these disability mm-hmm. There's also opportunities to work with employers in our community. So there's a lot of different ways to add services for an NP practice owner, in addition to taking care of the patients we need to be taken care of.
And I honestly find the nurse practitioner more willing to have the conversation about integrative practice as well.
Yeah.
Integrative medicine,
yes.
Holistic, you know, really body, mind, and spirit treatment, as opposed to just Western approaches to treating disease. It's more of an approach, a complete approach, holistic approach to staying well.
Absolutely. Actually, you brought up an interesting point when you talked about that, because I had attended a conference in Washington State and I met a gentleman who actually is an acupuncturist. He practices it. And he said it's a dying art. People are not going in to do this. Mm-hmm. And he's actually developing a program to train nurse practitioners in the delivery mm-hmm. of acupuncture treatments, because it has benefits for pain management, headaches, mental illness. I mean, there's just so many wonderful uses, and it gets us out of that pill prescribing mode.
That's
and
right.
Many other modalities that we can offer patients.
It's funny that the regulatory bodies will say you have to have, you know, a certain percentage of non-pharmacological approaches to this, that, and the other thing, but who's going to pay for that? I mean, we all want to do best practice. Okay, but then you have to give us the ability to not only train in those things, but to bill when we bring those practices in.
Exactly. Well, we're about to take our final break, and then we're going to wrap up and talk about the future of the nursing profession in its entirety, as well as the future of the nurse practitioner and making sure they have a seat at the table. And of course, a little surprise that the three of us have concocted that we will share with all of you in a few minutes. So that being said, please stay tuned right here on talkradio.nyc and on all of our socials, and we'll be back in a few.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Okay, everybody, and welcome back. Now, I got to say, just sitting here for the last half hour and really seeing the whole history of the nursing profession, I couldn't help but reference a little pop culture, thinking about the show MASH and how the Korean War was really highlighting the value that Loretta Swit's character, Major Margaret Houlihan, had in advocating and fighting for the nurses and their female independence and being able to stand for something that not only were they in the business of healing, but they were also showing that they were essential workers even without a pandemic, or in that case, it was wartime. But still, that show resonates to me not as a measure of fiction, which it was, but it was also representative about how the nursing profession was growing, especially, like you said, post-World War II. You know, so that on that level, when I then got the comparison from you, Lynn, about the nurse practitioner, I can truly see that during COVID, for example, the essential worker was considered anyone who was in the healthcare space. That I realized. But I would imagine that the nurses were elevated, whether nurse practitioner or RNs, were elevated to a hero type of status at that time, correct? I mean, that's my takeaway, but I wanted to know if that was going through in resonating with all of you in the field.
Well, I just remember the pictures on TV of the New Yorkers leaning out their windows and clanging their pots and pans, celebrating the healthcare heroes who were going to work. Yeah. Yes. And it's just interesting, too, because there was just a nursing strike in New York as well. So, you know, I think nurses are becoming in the forefront and being part of the discussion now instead of a side note. And I think that that's where we need to be. We need to be at the table with a seat. And if not one there, we should pull up a chair.
You know, exactly. Frank, the COVID thing was such that, you know, Lynn and I, we have gone to school and we've heard about interprofessional collaboration and we've read about interprofessional collaboration. We probably wrote about interprofessional collaboration, but we never saw it until COVID. You know, mm-hmm. And when you say that nurses were elevated, everybody was elevated. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody was on a level playing field. You know, some of us had to kind of grin and because everything was mostly medicine. And, you know, the surgery was just really, it wasn't even elective surgery. It was mm-hmm. emergent surgery. So the surgeons were relegated into the medical floors. Well, if you want to see a swan come out of the water and waddle like a goose, you know, you put surgeons on a medical floor and, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, which way do I go? And it was funny because, you know, we were trying to say, well, what do you do? And they go, what do you mean? What do? We're surgeons. You know, we do invasive things. So do invasive things, you know, so they joined in and intubated and put in central lines and put in the chest tubes that were necessary and found their way. Everybody found their way. Wow. The silver lining that came out of the COVID experience. And I know now a lot of people want to say we're dealing with burnout, we're dealing with mental health issues. And I'm not saying that some of our population isn't, but the people I coach nationwide are telling me that they are stronger than they ever thought they could be because of their COVID experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is the work, that's the language of growth. That's not the language of traumatic stress. Right. And what leaders need to understand and legislature needs to understand and our collective caring professions need to understand is that when people go through a transformative experience as COVID was for so many, mm-hmm. There's no going back. There's a sense of confidence and empowerment. There's no going back. And if you're a smart leader, legislator, or professional colleague, you capitalize on that. You don't try to stamp it down or corral it or hold it in check. You say, okay, let's take this new empowered whatever for a ride and see where we can go to make the industry of healthcare better and our collective caring professions that much stronger as well.
Absolutely. And as you know, Phyllis, Frank About Health, it actually began as an epilepsy show, but mm-hmm. it really went full force during COVID.
It sure did. Yeah.
It was just seeing the whole crisis we went through in New York alone for 5 months on lockdown. It had to be expressed. And, you know,
there's just so much need. You know, exactly. I mean, just pure and simple. I mean, you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to realize that There is so much need. So if we have ways of being able to serve those needs in creative new ways by very, very highly trained, competent professionals, why would we push back on that?
Absolutely. I just find it disheartening that when you have a certain administration just tear apart the 5 or 6 years of what we had built, it personally affects me on an emotional level, but mm-hmm. I do my best to continue to fight and advocate so that mm-hmm. we could at least own our healthcare, because that's what we all do during crisis points. So if every day is becoming a crisis, we just have to stay vigilant and continue to use our resources.
You know, the whole idea, you know, the thinking behind this, and I'm talking very spiritually here, the thinking behind this, mm-hmm. you know, is to shake us up a little bit and not take things for granted. And exactly. for us to be far more aware of what our health needs are and far more aware of how we have to own it ourselves and not just let somebody else take it over and really advocate for yourself first and, of course, advocate for others. And I do think, as Lynn suggested before, there are periodic rallying points that are indeed happening mm-hmm. and the genies are not going back in the bottle.
No,
people,
not.
You know, if you really want to coalesce people, give them one single thing to focus on. Mm-hmm. And I think that is indeed happening. And I know I feel like I'm in hip boots marching uphill in tar sometimes right now, you know, from a body, mind and spirit perspective. But I do think better times are coming.
It's interesting. Add something?
Oh, sure.
On that note, in 2019, Commonwealth did a survey and they surveyed the public to see who they would trust to fix healthcare. Who did they pick? Nurses.
Yep.
Yes.
So that was in 2019, mm-hmm. like before COVID. So mm-hmm. And then only our stock went up.
Yeah.
Through COVID.
And I think you're seeing now, I don't know the exact number, but there's got to be at least 10 or 12 political figures now holding national offices, whether at the state or the federal level, that are nurses. Mm-hmm. And once we start having nurses in places where, you know, policy and decisions are being made, this we can all rejoice on that, because we're the input is not going to be so much economic. It is going to be patient focused as well.
Absolutely. But to piggyback off of what you said, Phyllis, better times are coming. I wanted you both to share what you both are working on to show and reflect on those better times that are coming, whether they're books or podcasts.
Well, I'll just jump in real quick. I think those of your listeners who have listened to the show knows I've been writing a book forever, and I finally finished it. And, you know, the book is going to be addressing disruptive behavior in the workplace. It's going to be the missing puzzle of a healthy work environment, really understanding and effectively managing bullying and incivility in the workplace. Mm. And I'm hoping, fingers crossed, it's coming out in May. Yes. So thank you for the moment to let me plug that. But Lynn, tell us,
sure.
You have an article coming out and you also have a book coming out.
Yes. So I'm working on a book. It's going to be a tutorial for nursing students to learn about coding, billing, and documentation, because it's not very well taught in school. The curriculum is so dense, but this is such an important piece because we have to understand how we generate revenue for the places that we work and how we can negotiate better wages, better opportunities. And this book will help to do that. And we're also having a conference in Tampa for the nurse practitioners through the National Nurse Practitioner Entrepreneur Network. And that is going to be a business-focused conference. So we'll have topics that are really relevant, legal, financial practices, and vendors that specialize in NP information. So we're hoping that a lot of people will take advantage of that as well.
Nice. And I guess I can say that not next week, but starting with the week after that, for about 3 weeks, the three of us have agreed to do a mini series on the nurse practitioner or the nursing profession as a whole. Mm-hmm. Probably, if it's doable, you know, based on what is being released in the near future, we could actually create one of those three episodes as a webinar and teach the coding or teach some of the aspects of the nurse practitioner field that could also access your audience of nurse practitioners who could learn a lot with both you, Phyllis, and myself helping moderate things. We could have live interaction with those people who may ask questions. So I'm looking forward to using the Frank About Health platform from about, what is it, the 26th, I believe, till about March 12th, something like that.
Yeah. Let me very quickly here. So we are going to skip the 19th and start on the 26th. Yes.
Yes.
And so I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get a webinar format going, but we certainly can give highlights and overviews and maybe answer
some pearls of wisdom.
Yeah. Answer some great questions. You bet. Yeah.
And so, of course, we will be talking about that together offline over the next week or so, so we can prepare for that. But ladies and gentlemen, we are literally 1 minute to ending. So I just want to say thank you so much for this, for attending this special episode of Frank About Health. Frank About Health is doing what it can to continue on the fight towards managing disruption, as well as educating everyone out there about how to own your healthcare. And I think what you saw tonight is an example of how we are pivoting the show into little spin-offs in controlled blocks, but to be more educational and informative. 2026 is the year you need to arm yourself, whether you are a patient or a nurse or even a doctor for that fact. So that being said, I will come back next week with another episode of Frank About Health. And just everybody, if you have any questions for me, you can reach me at frankrharrison1@gmail.com or on my social media. I'm available on LinkedIn. I have my YouTube channel where my documentary, where Phyllis is in it, is also available to be seen, Being Frank for a Healthy Future. And I'll just see you all next week. Thank you both, Phyllis and Lynn, for being here. And we will see you both in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jesse, behind the scenes for engineering the show. All right. Take care. On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.